Welcome, adults of all vintages, to episode 165 of the Nerdstravaganza podcast, where all the adults are young and all works of fiction cater to them. I'm Tom.
I'm Brian.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Cam.
And tonight we are happy to welcome our special guest, Carrie Patel, author of The Buried Life, Cities and Thrones, and narrative designer for Obsidian Entertainment. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Happy to have you, and we are going to be discussing, of course, paleontology tonight, a topic about which we're told you know a great deal.
Tons.
So, yeah, this should be a great episode, one for the ages, you might say. Is the humor dry enough? What's the humidity?
It's Florida.
Yeah, right.
We're 50-50 tonight, aren't we?
How so? Yeah,
West Coast, East Coast.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Good point. All right. The continent is spanned. Anyway, before we get to tonight's topic, I do need to remind our listeners that they can check out our website at nerdstravaganza.com, hit us up on Twitter at nerdstravaganza, and of course follow our Nerdstravaganza Facebook page and join our Facebook group, Nerdstravaganza HQ. And of course, our swag blowout promotion to rival the Amazon Prime Day sale continues this month on iTunes, where all that we ask you for is a glowing review and maximum stars in exchange for a chance to win something cool. So be sure to leave your contact information along with your favorable review. And with that said, I think we can commence our episode. Carrie, we usually kick things off with a recap of our nerdy weeks that we call the Weekly Geekly Geekly Weekly Update, so called because we couldn't decide if it was Weekly Geekly or Geekly Weekly, so we just went with both. And with you now fully understanding
that's how most
that,
people react.
Okay.
I'll give the explanation. I'm a child of divorce. Don't make me choose. Anyway, Chris, why don't you show Carrie how it's done?
For my Geekly Weekly, it's been a little on the slower side, but I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to spend my Friday nights. Looking into Dark Matter and Killjoys. Right now, both of these space opera shows are just, you know, running neck to neck for me. So we'll see. For those who don't know, Dark Matter, which is based off of a comic book, is about six people who wake up with total amnesia on a starship and trying to figure out who they are and what's going on. And every episode seems to pile on a little bit more craziness. And then Killjoys is kind of a little Firefly-esque show about three bounty hunters in a very kind of corporate world where it's a very small system of four orbiting planets and evidently a lot of bounties to collect. Of course, as we know, with The Expanse coming up, I think in December this year, or it could be a little earlier, both of those shows are going to just, you know, fall to the wayside. Because, or I'm hoping, anyway, that early buzz is that The Expanse could be the Battlestar Galactica we've all been missing. And then I'm going to round out my Geekly Weekly by announcing that I have figured out what my Halloween costume is, because I start my Halloween costumes early so I can buy things in bits and bobs and make it a little more, you know, affordable, because I like to kind of blow it out when I buy, when I get something. I'm going to go with Steampunk Gentleman this year, because I finally realized that you can have gray hair and still make steampunk look cool.
I wish you would have said Cruella de Vil.
I've got the hair for that. I've got the black streaks and I've got the silver for that.
Cool is a subjective term, Chris.
Oh.
I'm just kidding. I like steampunk. I was just busting your
I've ears. Seen some steampunk gentlemen. They've got the mustaches and the monocle. I got to get a monocle. Like my kid says, you know why I have glasses, Dad? I'm like, no, why? Because monocles aren't in fashion yet. That's a good one. So that is pretty much it for my Geekly Weekly.
With that done, I think it will be Cam's turn now.
My week was pretty tame. I was on vacation, actually. I was up at Disney, stayed at the one of the resorts there on property, which is always nice. Took advantage of the amenities, the pool, and all that good stuff. Went to all the parks. Carrie, as the listeners and my fellow co-hosts know, I'm a Disney freak. I have an annual pass, so I go pretty much, I don't know, every other weekend. So that was basically what I did for the weekend. I got my, I got several rewards in from Kickstarter this week. I got Shinkunkan, which is a Japanese anime trading card game. I got that all the way from Japan, which is awesome. I also got Biblios Dice in, which is former guest Dr. Steve Finn, his newest project, and the dice version of Biblios the card game, which we all love very much. And I'm still gearing up to go to Gen Con. It's less than 2 weeks away. I'll be getting on a plane up to Indianapolis and, attending Gen Con for the first time. So I'm excited about that and representing Aiello, and all of their amazing board game offerings. And that's about it.
Sounds cool, Cam. I'll let you know that Nick, one of our Nerdstravaganza podcast alums, is also going to be up there. So I'll see if I can get you guys to hang out.
Nice. Yeah, I've met Nick before.
All right, Carrie, that's two sterling examples of how to do the update. Would you like to give us an update of your own?
Sure. So let's see. For my Geekly Weekly, I have been double-fisting my reading selections lately. I have picked up Cat's World, which is a Spanish cyberpunk novel that's about to be released. It's just been retranslated. And The Goblin Emperor by Catherine Addison, which is up for the Hugos, and I believe some other awards this year, too. Let's see, on the couch, I've started playing Borderlands 2 with my husband. We were very excited to find some more split-screen co-op games that we could enjoy together, and that because we are so slow and wait so long, are now much cheaper than they originally were.
Smart move.
That's what we tell people, but really we're just slow. And so it just works out that way. Let's see. I saw the most interesting Iranian vampire Western this weekend called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. It is also the only Iranian vampire Western I've ever seen, but it's quite good. And then I went down to San Diego, but I somehow missed Comic-Con. Instead, though, I did go to Mysterious Galaxy, which is a fantastic little specialty sci-fi fantasy bookstore down there. And got to read from Cities and Thrones with Scott Sigler and Wesley Chu. So that was a blast.
You read with Scott Sigler? He's actually one of my favorite authors. We've talked about him like the last couple weeks, because I just finished up the Galactic Football League series of his and a couple of the other things. How was that?
It was fantastic. He read the first chapter from his new book, Alive, and it's already on my Kindle list now. So that tells you about how it went.
Very
it was
cool.
Pretty exciting stuff.
All right, that's it. I got to get on the Sigler train.
Yeah, Infected is pretty awesome, too.
Who's got the book?
You got the book.
No, we've been passing it around. Don't you, Chris?
No, I don't have the book yet.
Didn't I give you... Tom, do you have it?
It's up in Seattle now.
Wow, that was a great update that I doubt... I will be able to top. I might just skip mine at this point, Carrie. Anything else, or is that pretty much it?
That was all for me.
That was incredible. Well done. Say hi to Tiny Tina for me, is all I can offer on Borderlands.
Awesome.
Brian, restore my confidence. Try to follow that up.
Not looking good. I didn't really do anything all that exciting. I did get in Viceroy from Kickstarter today, actually, so I haven't even had a chance to really look at that yet, but I'm pretty excited about that. Probably play it tomorrow night. I tried this thing over the weekend, pretty uncharacteristic for me, but neat nonetheless, and geeky enough. Have you guys ever heard of a cava bar?
Yes.
There's
a cava like Spanish champagne? No, I'm misunderstanding.
I don't think so. It's a cava root.
Yeah, it's...
Oh, yeah.
It gives you this, like, tingly, cool sensation. A lot of people who are in, like, recovery programs... For substance abuse, go to these places because the kava has a calming effect.
They say it's a mild anesthetic, so it actually numbs your tongue when you drink it. And it is just a calming drink, but it's also like a really calming environment. The one that we have in Hollywood has like a giant plaster tree in the bar. So you go into the building and there's just like, there's a giant tree with branches all over and things hanging off of it. And it's really cool. It makes you feel like you're outside. And, they play like Sade music and everything to just really slow everything down. A lot of fun.
In a very calm way.
Yeah. It was, they sell the drink by animal. So I had a turtle of kava.
So this was a turtle, a medium? Or a small?
Turtle was 5 shots.
The sizes don't matter, Chris, man. It's about just being calm and not worrying about things like that.
I have kava fail.
I may go for the otter next time. I'm not really sure.
Let me know when you go back. I'll pop in for a lemur with you.
I think lemur's actually on the menu.
I'm sure it is.
So is this one of those things where you also can eat like really, really spicy food after you have one because it numbs your tongue?
I guess I would be remiss if I didn't say this. It's kind of something you drink for the effect. It is probably the nastiest shit I've ever put in my mouth. And the guy told me, he's like, this is nasty. So what we do is we just slide you some pineapple. You drink it and then you just eat the pineapple and you forget all about it. He's like, it's nasty.
What kind of product is this? Taste our nasty, have a nasty drink. Like
it tastes like a root.
This place in business.
It tastes like you imagine a minced up liquefied root would taste, Cam.
It's very gritty. It's a little sandy. The liquid is clearly clouded.
Yeah. You gotta work on that delivery system, I'm just showing you.
Did you get a Groupon for it or something? trying to understand why you went.
I needed a Sade fix.
Jesus. People will typically either drink it with something else or, you know, have something right after. Yeah, something sweet. But it's for the effect. It really does, like, calm you down. And if you're struggling with – it helps people who are struggling. And that's an appeal for a lot of people.
I got you.
It was that or a semicolon tattoo, so.
All right, so the next time I'm really stressed, I'm going in for an elephant.
It will, it'll chill you out.
If they can put my tongue in a coma.
That's only temporary. Anyway.
I'm intrigued, too, just to further beat this up. They say it has anti-tolerance built into it somehow, so the more you drink, the less you need.
Yeah, I agree. I went for my standard family size pack of goldfish snack crackers after having kava, and I just a handful, and I was good. It was shocking.
So maybe after a few otters, the turtle will be enough.
I don't really eat goldfish snack crackers.
I really don't drink otters.
It's a fine product.
Okay, I really do. Honesty's the first step to recovery. All right, well, I'm glad you enjoyed your kava experience, Brian. Anything else?
Nope, kava and viceroy.
All right. Now that I'm thoroughly calmed down thinking about kava, I can deliver my update, which still won't live up to Carrie's, but here we go. I finished the video game Dragon's Dogma that I've been playing for like 17 episodes, got all of the Xbox Live achievements, which I know will impress everyone. And there is an expansion I can play, but it does not offer any achievements. So it's one of those scenarios where, you know, if I play a game and nobody's there to see my achievements, what was the point, really? So I think I'm just going to move on and prepare myself for Final Fantasy XIV. I long ago promised to join Brian in that game, as have you, Cam. So I think it is time. I'm ready to move on. I patched it recently, and I'm ready to do it.
I'm ready to go as well.
Yes. So see you soon, Brian, and thanks for being patient.
Believe it when I see it.
I literally think we've been saying that for like 12 episodes.
Well, yeah, it has literally been, yeah, a dozen is probably not far from accurate.
So how many episodes would have it been if you didn't have to go for all the achievements?
It's not even worth discussing because I had to go for the achievements. So
yeah, exactly.
I mean, gaming doesn't count if I can't brag about it to people who don't care. So. Anyway, I also watched the movie Jupiter Rising, I think it was called.
Oh, that stinker.
Am I wrong in assuming that was based on a book at some point, or it had the feel of it? No, it wasn't?
Nope, not that I was aware of.
That might explain some things.
Jupiter Ascending you're talking about, right?
Jupiter Ascending, not Rising.
Yeah, I believe it was a book.
Synonyms, they got me again.
Well, they did Cloud Atlas, and that was based on a book, and I think that was their movie just before Jupiter Ascending. The Wachowskis, so maybe it's...
Yeah, these are the same Wachowskis that gave us The Matrix, right?
So I hear.
Kind of.
Touche, right? Yeah. No, yeah. But yeah, they are failing to deliver because I saw that Cloud Atlas and came away confused. And I saw this and came away sleepy, so I don't know what happened.
Kava.
Yeah. Who? Like, was I on the convo? Were the actors? Were the writers? I don't really know what went wrong. Anyway, saw that. On to more interesting news, and this will give new listeners an appreciation for just how small my life is. I got a reservoir filter for my mopping robot such that when it does a damp mopping cycle in my house, the pad stays moist, and so the moisture in the damp mop is distributed evenly throughout my house. So let that sink in, the significance of that.
Carrie, Tom has an army of robot helpers at his house. It's truly a sight to see.
Yeah. My house is fully automated so that I don't ever have to vacuum.
I actually got a Roomba just a few months ago, and it's one of the best purchases I've ever made, so I can completely understand your enthusiasm here.
Thank you.
If you liked Roomba, wait till you try Scuba.
Yes, I will recommend iRobot's line of mopping robots to accompany your Roomba. They're really cool, and only people that own them really get it, so I'm glad you do.
And maybe with the Prime Day sale, like maybe I can get a, 10 cents discount?
Probably, unless you're looking for some Temptations Tasty Chicken Flavor Treats, which I'm looking at right now. They're for cats.
Mm-hmm.
$23.99. So an alternative to a vacuuming robot or mopping robot.
But, why only cats? Why do only cats get that?
I don't know, man. I'm just perusing the sale as we talk, okay? I didn't mean...
You can eat whatever you want, man.
Yeah, I mean, you're more than welcome to order that or a Philips Norelco beard trimmer. Anyway, moving on. I got to finish my update. I got my Amazon Echo. Speaking of Amazon, up and running. I talk to it. It replies. It also plays NPR. I told it to play NPR, and it played NPR. I found that kind of magical. The Amazon Echo is a tube with speakers that you talk to, and it consults the internet to answer queries, basically. It's kind of like the first iteration on the computer for Star Trek, so pretty excited about that.
Do you have NPR set up on your flash briefing?
Okay, so I don't quite get how the flash briefing works, and I'm glad you know about this too. Is the flash briefing something I can configure, or does the Echo learn my preferences, or what?
So how it works is you set, I think it has a number of different options that you can choose from in these stations. And like mine comes from NPR and The Economist, and organizations will pick like a few minutes worth of news that's sort of their highlight for the day or something. And so if you just ask for your flash briefing, it'll, you know, play the selections from whichever sources you've chosen. So it's just a few minutes long, you know, to get kind of your daily dose of kind of the most important stuff.
I like it. Okay. Good to know it's configurable, because I knew about that feature, but wasn't quite sure what I was being, what the rationale was behind my briefing. So now I do. By the way, best guest ever, guys. This is finally somebody's getting the things I'm talking about.
Don't tell Chuck that.
He didn't know anything about the Echo. Well, it wasn't out then. And I don't think he appreciated my Roombas. Whatever. Yeah, I mentioned I'm perusing the Amazon Prime Day sale, and then that's pretty much it. I might chime in now and then with a extreme bargain. But apart from that, I'm pretty much done with my update. And if we're all done with our updates, if nobody else has some last minute update ideas, I think we can move on to the news extravaganza, which is our news segment. I refrain from reporting on the news. I just sit back and ooh and ah at stories. Carrie, so you know, you are welcome to report or ooh and ah along with me. We'll keep the same batting order, starting off with Chris.
I mean, for news, what can you do? It was Comic-Con this week, right? Just looking over the coverage overall, I mean, I appreciated some of it, but I think, to my taste, it's getting to the point where cosplay is getting... I know why it gets a lot of coverage, but I think sometimes it's getting a little too much coverage. It's like, can we just dial it back, guys, and kind of stick with the news versus all the pretty pictures? Or maybe I'm just getting cranky in my old age.
Cosplay,
I don't know.
Packs them in.
Mm-hmm. It does. A couple of the highlights was the Deadpool trailer that was leaked. The non-leaked awesome Ash and Evil Dead trailer was great. Also got a big kick out of the Con Man trailer. That is the Alan Tyduck, Nathan Fillion web series they're doing. In fact, the setup for that is that Alan Tyduck is playing a less successful TV movie star who is basically making his living off the con circuit, while his more famous friend played by Nathan Fillion, because, you know, art does not imitate life whatsoever. You know, kind of rolling in the dough and kind of the jealousies and craziness of that. And both of them are connected by a – and what he's working the con circuit for is they were both part of a sci-fi TV show that was canceled way too early. And the clips they have that show the fictional sci-fi show actually look pretty good. I was like, can we actually see that show? Not that it looked anything like Firefly, but still, it was cool. There was a little more information on just a few more new clips on The Expanse, which I know I'm kind of hoping on. And then there was a little bit of a controversy with the Suicide Squad trailer. It was leaked as well. I don't know if you guys have seen it or not. But the WB was not happy that it got leaked, and they sent out a little – their PR person sent out a little bit of a, oh, we worked hard to make sure that it was a special exclusive for the Comic-Con folks. And but since you guys leaked it already, here it is live. Thank you very much. And also there's a little internet buzz that people really liked the song they heard with the trailer, which is I Started a Joke, which is kind of an obscure, a 1968 Bee Gees song that's being covered by somebody who's doing it in kind of a much more darker, more menacing, gothy version, which is something I've noticed with trailers recently. You know, if you want to make it kind of big and sexy, then you take like an old song and then you just kind of do it in a much more of a moody aspect. But Maleficent did it. Dracula the Untold Story trailer also did it. So,
Taco Bell did it.
Taco Bell as a commercial did it, of all things.
Yeah.
What song did they use?
I'd have to look it up, but yeah.
Mad World.
Mad World. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, they did.
Yep.
So I don't know, I'm still on the fence about that trend. I kind of like some of the covers they do, and some I'm kind of like, yeah, the Taco Bell commercial. What?
What was the Bee Gees song? Not that I would know.
I Started a Joke. That is the title of the song.
Okay.
And then the thing with that actual song is they just kind of came up with it, and they said, yeah, back in those days, there was a philosophy you could just put lyrics down and then let the audience find some sort of understanding to it, and then you just kind of went with it.
Back in those days?
Another thing I found which was very cool was there is an article where a Pakistani author is going on about how he thinks science fiction and fantasy should be more prevalent and should be encouraged in his country, because he feels that the culture in their country doesn't really embrace imagination enough. And he even quotes Neil Gaiman, because Neil Gaiman went to like the first state-approved science fiction convention, and he asked the representatives, he said, why are you guys doing this? And the rep said, well, we're really great at making things, but not inventing things. So we sent people out to Google and Apple and asked them, and we noticed that a lot of those people mentioned that they grew up with science fiction and fantasy in their life. So we want to introduce it in our culture now so that we hopefully will have a generation of imaginative thinkers. And cool. I thought that was awesome. And
that
of course
is awesome.
The link will be in the podcast. And that pretty much wraps stuff up.
Awesome, man. I will now transition over to Cam. Before I do, I will just mention that you can get a 15-day colon cleanse on the Amazon sale for $11.99.
Or you can just go to Taco Bell. It's the same effect on the 99-cent menu. Okay, let's see. Batman news. The comic book is going to do a crossover with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which I thought was kind of interesting. So look for that on the newsstands. Speaking of Batman, it appears that Ben Affleck will not only be playing Batman in the Batman vs. Superman movie coming up, but he will also co-write and star in and direct the next solo Batman film that will come after that. So whether you like him or hate him, Affleck seems to be here to stay in the Batman universe. Wesley Snipes, my favorite tax evader, is returning as Blade in a future Marvel cinematic universe production. I believe it's going to be a TV series, or it might be a movie. I don't know if it's going to be a TV series or not, but he's going to be continue as Blade.
Good.
Since I think he's on work release from the federal prison system. And my last news story is actually on the macabre side. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Nosferatu, the old 1920s black and white original sort of vampire movie. I think it was a silent film. The director of that movie, F.W. Murnau, has been lying, you know, he's been dead for a while. He's been in a German cemetery just, you know, there in the ground. And someone decided to dig up his body and steal his skull over the weekend. So officials are on the lookout for someone with a skull, I guess. But I thought that was kind of interesting. And that rounds out my news.
Okay. Thank you for that update, Cam. Takara Tommy official Pokemon XYMC001 2-inch Pikachu action figure can be had right now for $5.99.
Can't afford not to get it at that price.
Yes. The question is, how many do you want? Carrie, how about you? Any news to report?
Well, I saw some pretty exciting pictures on the internet this week. And before you go there, they were of Pluto. and apparently... the fantastic ice mountains that the scientists have said are on Pluto. So that's pretty awesome. Ex Machina came out on DVD. I don't know if you guys saw that one.
Yes.
I meant to mention that in my Geekly. I saw it and it was awesome. I loved it.
Yes. So I've already seen it. So I guess it's not huge news for me, but I guess it's great news for anyone who hasn't seen it yet because it's fantastic. So
couldn't agree more.
I guess those are my big news bits for the week.
Very cool.
Okay. Oh, this is a good one from the Amazon sale. If you don't own the game Timeline, you can get the music edition. Timeline's a trivia game, basically, for $7.92.
Tom, you introduced me to that game. I love Timeline, actually.
$7.92. Get it right now, Amazon Prime.
I'm going right now.
Join Prime right now. Brian, over to you.
Just expanding on the Pluto bit, and kind of the sci-fi influences creative thinking bit, it is my opinion we should just stop letting nerds name things. The mountains and valleys on Pluto were all named Morgoth, Balrog, Cthulhu. Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
No,
yes. Yeah. Yes.
That's awesome, though. You know, the elder gods. That's pretty cool.
I hope in 1,000 years people don't get like Zeus and Jupiter mixed up with, you know, Cthulhu and Xena and
Xena.
Well, I mean, how many Titans can you have? How many, you know, like,
that's cool. I didn't know that about this whole Pluto thing. So Pluto putting on this great face is not going to get it promoted back to planethood, right? I mean, it's just out.
Not according to Neil and Stephen Colbert, it's not. Because Stephen Colbert tried really hard.
Stephen Colbert being one of the great scientific minds of our time.
Right.
Oh, you didn't see the clip. He's with Neil deGrasse. I can always mispronounce his last name.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yes, yes. They go back and forth for about a good 5-10 minutes. Neil would rather demote Earth than promote Pluto.
Wow.
That's how adamant he is about Pluto never becoming a planet again.
So how is he defining a planet?
Okay, I only know this because I listened to Neil deGrasse Tyson's podcast. For a planet to be considered an actual planet, it has to be the dominant feature in its orbital disk or ellipse or whatever, such that it has cleared out all other competing bodies. You know, it's collided with them or moved them out of its orbit. And Pluto, I think, because of its erratic orbit or because it shares that orbit with other bodies, does not qualify as a real planet. Therefore, it is a dwarf planet. Wow, man, Neil would be really proud of me. When we have him on, I hope you're...
Yeah.
He's got some positive things to say. Awesome. Anything else, sir?
Nope.
Okay. Japanese washi masking tape set of 8 mini rolls. That's a starter set. $15.99 right now.
Starter set?
Well, you don't want to get into Japanese masking tape. You don't just want to rush in pell-mell. You want to start with a starter set, see what you like.
Work your way up to the intermediary set.
Right. You know, next thing you know, you got Hello Kitty dolls all over your house or something. You got to back into these things.
Comes with a face mask.
Yes. All right, I think we had a topic to discuss tonight. the Amazon sale is tempting, but I do believe given our guest's expertise, we wanted to discuss, and Chris, you came up with yet another amazing topic idea. That being the state of sci-fi and fantasy and the influence, presumably of sci-fi and fantasy and fiction in general, of YA, which stands for
Young Adult.
Young Adult, which does not mean teen, right? I mean, that's different. That does not mean teen.
No, no, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Okay. All right. Carrie, I should let you know that both Chris and Brian are men of the pen, and so you can totally, like, talk industry with them. And Cam and I communicate through grunts and cave paintings, so we may not be very insightful when it comes to this topic.
Yeah, and I'm not even good at that, so.
Yeah, I'm awful. I mean, I'm stick figures only, so. Anyway, Chris, I'll let you start off engaging our guests and getting the conversation going.
Oh, well, you know, for me, the way I've seen it is that for the publishing industry, the young adult genre, which used to be teen, which even used to be juvenile back in the day, way back in the day, has become kind of the PG-13 of the publishing industry. You know, PG-13 for movies. The vibe is they're trying to cast the widest audience to get the most people in the theaters, and they're trying to reach out and build franchises as much as they can, build universes as they can. And that's kind of bled over to the publishing industry because that's where they find some of these franchises with Divergent, Hunger Games. I mean, I don't even know why I'm bothering listing them. Harry Potter, pretty much if you're a geek and you're listening to this podcast, you probably could name all these. So I'm wondering how that influences, you know, really working on what's going with, you know, publishing. Because there's a lot of intersections, a lot of the science fiction and fantasy authors I know, they're working on young adult. They're doing young adult these days. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just, you know, looking at the trends and seeing what's going on. We could start from the beginning. What's the difference between a young adult and a novel that has a young adult protagonist? Because you can have two different things that way.
So one thing I've noticed about young adults, and I think this might partially address your last question there, is that, you know, those novels seem to be very focused on sort of the experience of the protagonist. I feel like you see a lot more novels nowadays that are written in either first person or close third person, which is pretty much always how young adult novels, at least as far as I've noticed, are written. And those are very intimate perspectives to have with the protagonist. And they allow the protagonist's experience to be very visceral and very personal. And so even when you have these characters like, you know, Harry Potter and Hogwarts, or, you know, Katniss Everdeen and, you know, her dystopia, you know, like they're, even though these experiences are somewhat outlandish, they're really grounded in relatable experiences that the protagonists have as they're also, you know, transitioning into adulthood and questioning the authority figures around them. And, you know, just sort of starting to find their place in the world. And I feel like it's that level of the experience, which is pretty relatable for pretty much almost everyone, that makes young adult such, you know, such an enjoyable and accessible genre for so many people. And something that I think has bled over to a lot of non-young adult fiction, again, just in terms of, you know, sticking to a really close perspective with your protagonists and, you know, really getting sort of their emotions and their state of mind to come through on the page.
What is it that they like to say? If you have outlandish characters, you need to have a familiar background or familiar setting. But on the flip side, if you have an unfamiliar setting, you need to have very relatable characters, very familiar characters.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. And there's certainly makes a lot of sense.
Yes. By the way, Chris, if you want me in on the conversation, like dumb the question down, but, you know, put it to me in a very concise fashion, because as I professed before, I am completely ignorant about this topic. So I don't want to be like, yeah, the book and then the protagonist, you know.
I liked Harry Potter too.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, everybody can weigh in because, you know, everybody here has been a reader of that sort of thing. So you can, I've seen that, or this is how I feel.
In that case, I'll let you move it forward, and I will endeavor to put in with my silly comments.
Please do. I'm still trying to, because I'm working on a YA novel in the back corner, and I'm still looking at it and trying to piece together myself, is this really a young adult novel versus, you know, just I have young adults that are protagonists in more of an adult novel. Or if the line's blurred so much, you don't know. Like Chuck Wendig, one of our favorite guys, he had a blog post where he had to talk about, hey, I did a young adult novel, and then I got angry little emails from little mothers that said, oh, no, you have cursing in my young adult novel. I can't have my children read this now. And he's like, what? And then, you know, there was also J.K. Rowling, who had people emailing her and saying, hey, your characters are growing up and the stories are getting darker. We can't have this. I want Harry Potter to stay the same sort of formulaic story that we had for the first two or three novels. So I don't know. I think it might start blurring to the point that you can have quite a level of adult issues and discussion in a young adult novel compared to the previously think of it as just something for kids.
You guys probably know this. Who's the target audience? Who are you targeting? And what do they want to read as evidenced by sales?
I think that's one of the surprising, well, to some people surprising things about young adult is that, you know, many readers, you know, seem to be in the, I guess, 13 to 18 year old category, but a lot of readers are in their 20s and 30s.
Maybe one of the strategic reasons for young adult versus teen is your older readers aren't necessarily put off by reading teenage fare, I guess.
I don't think so. And I feel like a lot of that probably comes back to, you know, just having these characters feel very present and very personal.
So that crosses generations, obviously. In other words, if you can relate to a character, you can relate to a character.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And you guys read Harry Potter as well, right? I'm taking mm-hmm. that from our conversation.
Absolutely.
I read that when I was definitely out of the young adult age range, but I had a ton of fun with it. It sounds like you guys did too.
Yeah. Yeah. I was well out of the age range myself, but I was outraged that there was witchcraft and such in it. I wrote the author.
Well, we have to give Harry Potter props, right? Because that was the first one that really did what it did to the young adult market. It's the one that broke all the rules.
You well, know, I honestly believe books would be dead if it weren't for Harry Potter.
Really? Yeah, I'm amazed people still even read anymore. I mean, I feel like, I mean, we all love to read, but I mean, we're older. I'm shocked when I see a kid with a book because, you know, it just seems like it's all feed me 2 minute bites of this and that, and that's it. I'm shocked when I see a kid sit down and read a book.
You don't think Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Vine is the future or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Good friend of mine actually posted on Facebook the other day that his son asked for a hardback edition of a book. And I mean, wow, really? You know, in the age of digital readers and presumably kids not wanting to read, that's a great gift for your child to ask for, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That's awesome. There's still a market for author signatures, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah.
eBay.
Somebody signed my Nook and that was pretty much it for the device. Kind of sucked. As far as the more, you know, adult content, I mean, and I'm not trying to indict anybody's personal moral code or anything here, but I don't know. Remembering when I was a teenager, like, I don't really think you need to write it at an infant's level. You know, these are teenagers. These are, in fact, young adults. These are people who are, you know, coming of age, and adult topics are more accessible to them now. So I don't.
It would not be rated PG-13.
Even the book content translated to movie would not get a PG-13 rating, Brian? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, the cheesy, you know, Hollywood version of it might, but like the actual content would not, I don't think.
Oh, because of the sexual content, the language, et cetera?
Yeah, usually it's the sex that I wouldn't say I object to it, but I find it interesting.
A disconnect.
Yeah, a disconnect. Like, I am surprised that, seriously, you know, you say shit in one novel and they tear you apart, but, and I'm making a joke out of it, but I'm not joking with, you know, werewolf, werebear, wereboar orgies. And the mom buys it for their 13-year-old, 14-year-old girl. With no problem.
Do they? I think yeah, mom reads it too. Well, I suspect mom reads it too.
I mean, suspect mom doesn't have any idea what she's buying.
I suspect mom would have a totally different take on Animal Planet if she did, right?
we haven't mentioned the other one, Twilight. I think mommy buys things too. I mean, 50 Shades of Grey, which was based off Twilight. There's some mommy action going on there.
Twilight has the were animals, though, right, Brian? Is that to what you were... You're exaggerating.
Fifty Shades of Grey is not young adult. Yeah, that's not mom's buying the X-rated shit, and that's fine. I'm all for that. I'm just surprised that mom lets her kid read such scandalous stuff.
I guess it's better that, you know, the kid reads it there than on the internet, though, right?
I think that may be the answer, because they're doing it no matter what.
Exactly.
What can you buy them that they can't get for free?
Honestly, the grammar on the internet is just atrocious. I wouldn't want my kid to read anything raunchy there. So Brian, you are definitely taking issue with Chris's assertion from earlier that YA is akin to PG-13. It sounds like it's more like PG-17 plus or something.
I agree with his analogy. I just think that YA-13 has a much broader review board than a movie would.
To Carrie's point, I think you get more latitude with the written word because, and probably not for no reason, you know, reading is seen as something a little more noble than watching a movie or surfing the internet. And I think everybody wants to see their kid read, and better that they read it in a book that somebody took the time to craft than on a message board.
Well, I think part of that also is people have a much more visceral reaction to a visual medium than they do read. I mean, I can't tell you how many times when I was much younger and I'd be hanging out with the artistic buddies and some guy would be like, yeah, I'm an artist. And then he slips on his phone and he shows people pictures of, you know, what he's working on. And people are like, ooh, and ah. And I'm like, I'm a writer. Here's a poem you could read in 5 minutes. It's just, there seems to be a much more visceral, immediate reaction. And people think they have a stronger reaction to things that they see and hear as compared to what they think they read. And maybe that's because some people really aren't readers. I mean, for me, I get reactions because I like to read. But maybe for other people, they look at it and it's just words on the page. They know intellectually what it means, but they don't make that connection.
Reading requires some work, though. One problem I have with reading is sometimes I can't get past a certain section if I'm not able to get my brain to wrap around it. In other words, if I can't visualize something, I'll put the book down until I can. It might just be because I'm dumb. But I think a lot of people, as you said, they comprehend the words, but there's no spark going on in their brain. And so reading does not connect with them in the same way as watching Jupiter Ascending might, because you think people's less visceral reaction to the written word stems from the difficulty they probably have in conjuring up any images from it?
Oh, I definitely would have to agree with that. I mean, for the longest time for me personally, my visual imagination is what prompted me to write, because I would just see a really cool scene in my head and I'd want to get that down on the page. And then there would be a big ass disconnect.
So you had that scene played out, and now what?
And yeah, you know, I write it and I'm like, that's not even close to the awesomeness I see in what's my head. How about you, Carrie? Do you have that going on too, or is it a little different for you?
I do. But you know, I think that probably happens to some extent in just about any medium, you know, like even if you're a filmmaker, even if you're a painter, like I think that's one of the hard things is getting used to this idea that, you know, what you haven't created yet, what you're imagining is perfect. It's kind of like a great movie trailer. Like you kind of see the broad shape, you see the outline and you sort of feel the effect, but you know, you have to flesh it out. And that's, you know, that's always the hard part. And I think that tends to fall at least somewhat short of, you know, of what the creator really wants in any medium.
The tools are just too crude at the end of the day.
Was it? Somebody said the artist always wishes for more talent, and the talent always wishes for more artist.
Also, though, Chris, I think to your point that when you're reading something, you're almost along for the ride with the author, because whatever they're describing on the page, you're the one that's sort of interpreting that in your own brain. So your reaction to that is based on your own experiences and your socialization to whatever you're reading. You know, yeah, it may be a sex scene and there may be sexual things going on in the writing, but what you're imagining is probably based on your own experiences. Whereas when you see something on the screen, it's just, you're just being fed what the director or whoever put it on the screen is doing or did for that scene. So I think that's why you probably get a different reaction from that as opposed to what you've read. And so I think that's also probably what feeds to where there's a little less I guess, you know, people being up in arms about things when they're reading as opposed to seeing it on the screen.
To me, that you know, that kind of sounds like how Stephen King said that writing is a form of telepathy. You can mention a rabbit on a checkerboard tablecloth, and we all see the rabbit and we see the tablecloth, but individually in our heads, we see maybe a brown rabbit, maybe a white rabbit, and the tablecloth could be blue, it could be red, versus that director's pumping things to you. It's more like I'm seeing exactly what I see, and I can't unsee it with my eyes. It's too much.
Right. It's their interpretation rather than your interpretation of what their interpretation is.
You can't self-censor it. Maybe when you're reading the sex scene, you do it in a nice, clean, you know, family lifetime style blue
missionary
moon shape.
Position. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And just for our audience, we're using that set up as an example. We're not hung up on the sex in books. We're just...
Well, it's worth mentioning because that's a kind of flashpoint in our culture. You know, that's something that people have strong feelings about being depicted, and especially being presented to people of a certain age, you know? So it's...
Absolutely.
So I have another question, and this is, I'll admit, pilfered from the outline Chris came up with for the episode. I'll put this out to you first, Carrie, but anybody can chime in. Prior to either the advent of or the labeling of the YA genre, what might I have read in my youth that would qualify today, if anything? Or is this really a genre just cut out of stone by J.K. Rowling or somebody?
You know, out of some of the stuff that I read when I was a lot younger, I'd say probably Lloyd Alexander's Chronicles of Prydain. I think when you might have mentioned The Black Cauldron, Taran the Pig Farmer, and Gwydion the King. But, you know, most of the books follow Taran, who's, you know, I think of the same age as a typical YA protagonist. And, you know, his story is also very much about kind of finding his place in the world and figuring out, you know, who his parents are and where he came from, and kind of what his personal role is in this big adventure that he and his friends are involved in. I think perhaps also Ursula K. Le Guin's A Wizard of Earthsea.
Oh, yes.
I read that one when I was a lot younger. Yeah, and it's a similar story about, you know, it's a young man who's, you know, plucked from, I think, the islands that he grows up on and sort of brought into this, you know, wider world of magic and intrigue. And he kind of has to navigate not only the challenges of learning this discipline, but also sort of the ulterior motives of many of the, you know, supposed friends and authority figures around him. And I think that learning how to navigate those relationships is a pretty big part of YA as well.
YA in a certain way is probably resonates with somebody who is trying to negotiate those very things in real life, you know, how to interact with others, where they are in life and how they relate to people around them, I guess. Is that fair to say?
I think so.
You know, and in that respect, it almost makes me tempted to think that's why young adult is very resonant for geeks, because a lot of us are socially awkward. So even when we aren't, even though we're no longer adolescents, that the magic of the unspoken social rules that just seem to fly past us is still, you know, a very confusing world.
Huh.
Even as we get older.
Is that something you deal with there, Chris? I don't understand.
So, you know, I want to throw out, I think, A Wrinkle in Time would also be a good fit, too. And just to recap also, I mean, back in the day, H.G. Wells didn't write science fiction. He wrote War of the Worlds. Now we have young adult, so.
Yeah, but I don't think War of the Worlds would be young adult.
No, I'm just, for an example, just further explaining why we're going back in time.
What about Tolkien, young adult or not?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
100%.
Hobbit, definitely.
I can see a pitch for it, honestly.
I was saying that jokingly, but now that I think about it, you know, this is somebody emerging from this sheltered existence into a broader world. It seems kind of akin to the way Carrie was describing the Earthsea experience.
Exactly.
Yeah. Leaving the Shire and moving out into the broader world. Yeah.
Because he's, you know, it was a children's book, but the character was a young adult hobbit. He wasn't a teenager either.
That's a good point.
Mind blown.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Wow.
You know, and a lot of these young adults, the I wouldn't say the template, but the tropes are the chosen one, you know, or that special person. because everybody wants to feel their special inside, that they're the special snowflake.
That's a whole nother conversation, but yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Although,
put a pin in that one.
May I propose another genre, like not so young adult, where the special snowflake training, you know, is dispensed with, and we start to accept that we're one of many snowflakes in the world.
Yeah, special snowflake gets slapped around and realizes the world is not the right way your parents told you it would be.
Being part of a flurry isn't necessarily a bad thing. Guys, any other examples you wanted to add in there, or other questions you had for Carrie specifically?
Well, I would ask, I have a couple questions for Carrie, but I was just going to ask one more. Lovecraft, young adult or not? I'm joking, but
young Carrie, racist maybe.
Yeah, right. Carrie, I'm just curious. I'm always curious as to like the market dynamics and things like that of everything, but especially publishing. So when you sat down to write The Buried Life and Cities and Thrones, did you decide? I'm sure it was like sort of, you know, you had the story probably in your head, but once you started writing it and you got with a publisher, how much of it ended up being your vision and how much of it was astute telling you, well, maybe this is going to work better for audiences. You know, we should change this to make it more appeal, you know, to give it a wider appeal. And, you know, was that a battle that you had to fight, or was it pretty much an easy process that you didn't have to worry about?
That actually didn't happen for me, but I know what you mean. I do hear of a lot of authors who, have a publisher or someone, you know, tell them, well, you know, this is what we think will sell. Right. You know, which is always, it's always a guess. It's an educated guess. But, you know, what made Harry Potter sell was not sort of the long line of, you know, young wizarding boy books that had gone before it. It was just a really well-written, relatable story. Angry Robot, which was my publisher, was actually, they actually had a very light hand, in edits and revisions. And, you know, the things they suggested were really just more along the lines of, clarifying and enhancing, characters and story elements that were already present. They really didn't ask me to, you know, change a character, change a storyline, add a subplot, just because they thought it might sell well. And I think probably some of that has to do with, kind of their slice of the market, which is a lot of the stuff that falls between the cracks elsewhere. Their tagline is SFF and WTF. And so I think, yeah, a lot of us are in the WTF category, which means I think we get to try a lot of really interesting new things.
No, that's so great. That's refreshing to hear.
Props
because
to Angry Robot then.
Yeah, definitely. That's refreshing because, I mean, it's almost transparent, especially in movies, you know, when you see just sort of a amalgamation of what you can tell was just a bunch of suits sitting in a room saying, okay, we need to have a strong female character, and we need to have a Hispanic character, and we need to have a black character, and, you know, we need to make sure that, you know, we appeal to everybody, and so we can maximize our revenue, and it's just, I don't know. It to me, it's rubs me the wrong way a bit.
Well, and it also ends up very, very many times being very shallowly done. You mm-hmm. know, it's, you see a lot of remakes nowadays. I think that's as great an example of anything of just kind of trying to grab a formula that worked once and just reproduce it without even really pretending to try to, you know.
Oh, we're greatly looking forward to Independence Day too. If you didn't listen to our last podcast,
turn sarcasm off.
Oh, man.
What about that though? Is it economics winning the day there, or have we just reached a point? You know what? I may have just answered my own question to my own satisfaction, but I'd still like your opinion. Is it just, look, we're going to put money behind this project. We want to put it behind what we know will be a winning project.
Probably. And I mean, I think especially when you're talking about, you know, a movie which costs millions of dollars to make, you know, that's really risky. And so it's probably much easier to take risks on things like books, which, you know, don't cost nearly that much money and don't need to make nearly as much in order to be profitable. Mm. You know, I think, you know, studios want something that's easy to pitch, easy to sell, and it's going to, you know, grab somebody's attention amidst a lot of noise.
Carrie, why don't you tell us a little bit about your works and where you think they fit in the landscape of readers nowadays?
So my first book, The Buried Life, is a mystery set in an underground city called Recoleta. It's Angry Robot classified it as science fantasy, and I'm really glad they did because I really didn't know what to call it myself, which made querying it pretty interesting. It's speculative fiction. It has light fantastical elements. It takes place at an indeterminate time in the future. And there's a lot I don't want to tell you because it gives away quite a bit about the end. And then the sequel, Cities and Thrones, is more of a political thriller in the same type of setting. I would almost, if I had to pick a label that I've seen a lot of recently, I would almost pick New Weird, which is a lot of the stuff you see, like China Mayville, Robert Jackson Bennett's City of Stairs, just, stuff that has its own sort of unique sensibility that, maybe pulls flavors from a lot of different places, but like, it's not Victorian London with vampires, and it's not, urban fantasy, and it's not medieval Europe with dragons. It's stuff that's kind of its own niche. And so I think a lot of these works tend to kind of, get put together because they're hard to classify otherwise.
Like a lot of Vandermeer stuff, right?
Yeah.
What was your sort of Doc Brown, hanging a clock fella and hit your head on the toilet sort of like, inspiration for the universe that your books are set in?
Actually, just before I started writing the first one, I took a trip to Buenos Aires, Argentina, and there's a really lovely cemetery there in a district of the city called Recoleta. And, if you've ever been to New Orleans, it's kind of that same sort of look with these, really lovely above ground mausoleums, except, this in the city, they're kind of tightly packed together and they have these really charming little cobblestone streets between them. And I think it was just sort of that image of a place that was, kind of somber and kind of beautiful in a sort of macabre way. And, just sort of getting all the what ifs firing of, well, what if someone did live here? Where would they live? Well, they'd have to live underground because there's not quite enough space up here. And, oh, well, why would they be underground? And what would they do there? And if this is what the surface looked like, what kind of technology would they have?
Yeah, I like that it's not, like you said, the traditional formulaic, dragons in Europe or, Victoria London. And it's cool. I like that it's a different setting that you can sort of wrap your head around.
Very, yeah. And it seems to fit with Angry Robot's, what's the word I'm looking for? Philosophy. Yeah, cool.
Well, I think there's a big market for like new weird sort of people who aren't looking for the same old, but when you try to pitch that, then it's a whole different story because people, they want to get a pitch that's very similar to stuff they heard before, or maybe you had a different experience with your stuff when you were down in San Antonio WorldCon.
I found Angry Robot to be very receptive, but I had tried to pitch to mostly other agents in the past, and I think one of the challenges is trying to be clear and concise, and especially when you're talking about speculative fiction, you don't need to lay out the history of your world, but you want people to understand, where it's set and what the basic outline of the story is, or at least what the hook is. And I think for something that doesn't necessarily have a lot of really clear genre predecessors, or models, that can be difficult. And, one of the things about something that's science fiction or fantasy is that has to be part of the pitch. If it's a mystery, but it's a mystery in an underground city that doesn't really exist and is actually sort of in the future, and it's like, well, wait, that's not mystery. That's science fiction or fantasy, one of the two. But the story may still be a mystery or a romance or anything else. And getting that stuff in the package, getting it across quickly and clearly, without rambling on as I am right now, is the really hard part.
Oh, I agree. I went to one panel once, and a young lady was trying to explain her pitch for a young adult novel. And it was just, it rambled on. And it was, I almost wanted to go, time out. You need to kind of think that over because she just dived into the world and dived into the relationships and like, what was the story? Mm-hmm. She had all that kind of still bubbling in her head and didn't really boil it down to what the story was.
Mm-hmm. Well, she wanted people to buy the book. So do you have any future works planned for Ricoletta, or are you working on any other projects outside of that universe, or maybe peripheral to that universe?
Right now I'm working on the third book in the series.
Okay. And how's that going?
It's going well. It's the wonderful honeymoon stage where I have an outline I'm really excited about and a few words on the page, and I haven't hit any of the terrifying snags yet, so everything is great.
You have a really great feeling set of ideas in your head right now, right?
Exactly. It's that trailer stage. The, you know, you've got the idea in your head. You haven't put it on the page yet.
What, the shoe has not yet dropped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's your process? Is it like, you know, you sit at home with a cup of tea, or is it like a bad 80s movie where you go out to a cabin in the woods somewhere? And what's your like process when you sit down to write?
It's usually coffee or tea in the morning and wine in the evening. I do have a day job, as I mentioned to you guys, so I try to wake up a couple hours early, and you know, luckily I'm a morning person, and carve out a couple hours to do some writing, and then when I get home, take care of all the necessary stuff, and then try to finish out with another hour or two. But I tend to be a big outliner. I don't necessarily have to follow the outline to a T, but I find that momentum really keeps me going, and it's, you know, it's as I'm following the outline and following those plot points that I discover little surprises in the characters or in the story that are sometimes what the novel really becomes about, or what really drives the next scene forward. But I need at least that roadmap to get going.
Do you find when you sort of look back on the things that you've written that they were influenced by maybe what was going on in your life at the time when you were writing? And by the way, I applaud you for doing all this stuff while you have a day job. I mean, that's amazing. I know that if I had to do it, I probably couldn't. So that's amazing. But do you think that, like, what, you know, your own experiences and what's going on in your life set a tone sort of for your writing?
Not that I've noticed, but maybe you should ask my husband or someone else close to me who's reading over my shoulder. Say, oh yeah, that was happening. You know, one of the reasons I love writing short stories, and I don't write them a ton, but I have a lot of fun every time I do, is because I feel like you can really easily just seize on a moment or an idea, or just, you know, something that's very ephemeral, but very intense for a brief period of time, a few hours, a couple days, and just write off of that emotion or that idea. For a novel, I find that those feelings and those ideas kind of ebb and flow. And so I don't really think that, you know, something that's happening around me or in my life or, you know, to the people around me, I don't think that stuff tends to really play a big role in what I write, just because I have to have it, you know, again, already planned out. And by the time I get to whatever plot point I've laid out, you know, whatever I was thinking of when I wrote it is long since passed.
Gotcha. No, that's very interesting, because I'm always fascinated by the creative process, because I'm woefully unartistic. So when people create things, like, you know, just out of nothing, I'm always in awe of that. I guess my last question would be, and I'm sort of monopolizing, I'm sorry, I'll let everyone else jump in, but my last question would be, if you could talk to your younger self, or, you know, an aspiring artist or aspiring writer out there, you know, and give them some pointers as to, you know, what maybe they could do, what would they be?
Probably read it aloud. I think that's a big, at least for written work, that's huge, and it's really tedious, and it doesn't always seem necessary, because when I'm reading a book, I don't read the words aloud. But there's something about hearing the words that gives you a sense for what, especially in dialogue, for what sounds natural and what doesn't, and for what is, you know, concise and easy to understand and clear and what isn't. And I think that cringe factor of kind of hearing, ooh, wow, that's a really awkward sentence, can be a much easier way to, you know, get you to write a better one than just sort of noodling around with it and trying to figure out what looks good on the page.
Yeah. No, that's interesting you say that, because I basically draft documents for a living. And so I do that all the time, because you know, you know what you want to say. So when you read over something, you're just sort of assuming that that's what it sounds like, you know, but it's different if someone else were to pick it up and read it. And so reading it aloud, so you're right, gives it that sort of, maybe like a third person effect. Mm-hmm. Or even reading backwards sometimes. I read backwards just to see, like, you know, what am I really trying to say here, and is it coming across? But that's interesting. Guys, any other questions?
I was curious if you've heard what you've heard about or played with the Patreon model.
I haven't tried that at all. And that's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, when you're a creator, you sort of put some of your work online and you allow people to sort of support you as you go forward.
Part of my question is, I look at it and I'm kind of a little confused myself. It seems like some people do it that way, or some people say every time I write a short story that's cool, I'll charge you a little bit and then you'll get to see it first before I try to pitch it anywhere else, if it ever goes anywhere else. Because that seems to be like, for a lot of these guys, it seems like I would like to do other cool little things, but without making money on it, I can't do that. If you're a fan of mine, then here's a way for you to pay me so you get some exclusive content for a little bit. Then I can do it guilt-free compared to, like, you know, doing something I want to do, but it doesn't put food on the table.
Well, and I think one thing you said, what my instinct about, you know, doing a Patreon or anything else like this would be that, you know, you have to be producing a lot of work and a lot of different kinds of work, you know, because I think you're going to have a hard time selling a short story to, you know, a magazine, for instance, if you've already put it out elsewhere. You know, some magazines will buy reprint rights, but, you know, I think a lot of them typically want a first stab at, you know, good new material. So, you know, yeah, that seems like that would be an interesting model if you're creating something that's not quite blog format, and, you know, not your short story or novel either, but just, you know, something else that you want to give to, you know, your closer fans. But it's not a model that I've experimented with myself.
Yeah, I definitely would think you'd have to be a writing machine to include that in your repertoire, you know. Unfortunately, some of us cannot write 1 billion words a day.
I can. I mean, I'm not sure there are anything anybody would want to read, but I can definitely just spew 1 billion words a day onto paper of some sort.
I can copy paste 1 billion words a day.
Oh, yeah, actually. Once you get 1 million, it's really trivial to get to 1 billion, isn't it?
I have my electronic monkeys bang that out.
That tip that you should read the things you write, I think I'll apply in my day-to-day communications, because I have just a constant problem getting my point across to people. I think I state things in a concise way, and I tend to confuse people.
Might be too concise?
Maybe, or maybe I'm too wordy and I think I'm concise, but it gets me in trouble communicating, and it gets me in trouble on social networking sites where I say a thing and people take it completely the wrong way. So I'm going to have to read it in various voices. I'll read it in my voice. I'll read it in, like, sneering voice, you know, like that. See how it comes across, you know, just put it through its paces to see how it comes across.
I think emoticons are the way to go for social media, because that's definitely somewhere people bring a lot of themselves to what they read.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed.
Emoticons.
Yep.
And of course, you don't have the benefit of emoticons in actual written work, so I guess you just have to know how to write in that case.
I feel like in the future, it's just going to be emoticons.
It's
going to be a book full of emoticons.
Oh my god. Like
sunrise, smiley face.
Yeah.
What are you doing that for, Winky? Like, oh no, please. Did I just read that? He said. Like, no. Well, guys, anything else for Carrie before we begin the wind down? She's been a great guest.
Very good sport, yes.
Going once, twice, three times. I almost feel like I should pull something else from the Amazon sale, but I think I've beaten that horse to death. How about we round it out with a Bondi Band Solid Moisture Wicking Headband? Just a headband that wicks moisture, and that's $13.49 right now. Comes in many colors. Anyway, we have a little while left on the Amazon Prime sale, so we should probably wind up the episode so Carrie can go take advantage of the savings. Carrie, for my part, I'll say you've been a great guest and really enjoyed having you on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Carrie. Take care.
Okay, guys. Well, another excellent episode of the Nerd Extravaganza podcast with a most excellent guest. I think we all agree.
Absolutely.
And we'll remind our guests that you don't have to wait for a once-a-year sale to take full advantage of the Nerdtravaganza podcast. We do invite you to subscribe to us on iTunes, write us favorable reviews, etc. And if streaming is more to your liking, we invite you to check us out on Stitcher.
Join us on social media by liking us on Facebook, following us on Twitter and Instagram, adding us to your Google Circle, and joining the Nerdtravaganza HQ Facebook group.
Head on over to our website, nerdtravaganza.com, where you can check out this and all of our back episodes. Pop on over to YouTube after that and type in Nerdtravaganza into the handy-dandy search bar, and you will find all of our movie reviews, board game reviews, and other premium content. And after that, shoot us an email at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out Carrie Patel at angryrobotbooks.com, where you'll find her books and all of the other authors that are under that label.
And with all that said, Chris, take us away.
Mr. Flush says, you can buy a plunger at the Amazon Flush Sale.
Pretty good.
I was just pulling it out of my ass. I was about to say.
You were really, literally pulled it out of your ass. Well done.
Mr.
I was about to say, I have no idea, guys. Give me an idea. And I was like, we'll bring Mr. Flush back.
The pulling it out of your ass part, I have to say, too. That was perfect.
Yeah.